Ziegler Morris, and this is our last session on church and state. And I thought what we would do would be to outline the positions that we've covered so far, put them on the board in a continuum, and then maybe divide up and just see if we had to pick one, which one we'd pick, and try to share with each other why. And we'll see how long that takes us.
Tony wasn't listening.
Okay, does anybody remember the first position of the early church?
You mean origin?
No, well, let's
I know what you're talking about, the Christ over culture, the Christ up culture.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, let's start back all the way with the Old Testament. Way back to Holy War and all that kind of stuff. Kingship.
I mean, I think you started before.
That was only at your second session.
Okay.
Well, that was it.
Well, how about the church after Constantine? I remember that was
Christ. 312 on, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, Christ of culture. And can you remember any of the characteristics of what that position looks like? Maybe think of a modern example or something.
Well, that's where, like, the president or the emperor, in that case, was a Christian. Mm-hmm. And that was the approved religion for the entire Roman Empire. So that covered a lot of territory.
Mm-hmm. But the state church of Norway.
Yeah, that would be an example. Where you just, there's no conflict between being a Christian and being a citizen. And in fact, part of what culture is doing is Christianizing, or trying to. Another way that you might find this position would, I'm thinking of the church that I go to at home, very socially active church, and it's a Methodist church actually, and really not a lot of doctrine there, and people come to this church because they want to be involved somehow in downtown ministries to the poor. So they come feeling just very tolerant, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And they see Christ in each person that stands in line to come into the soup kitchen. And they're not really interested in drawing distinctions between, well, there's a Christian and there isn't, because they see Christ everywhere. Can you see a weakness with this position? All of the positions have good things and bad things. And there are many good things and many bad things. What are some bad things?
Well, you take your religion for granted.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there. You don't have to work too hard at it.
Yeah, it easily can be bad.
Are they, would a weakness be they're always so busy doing, they don't have a reflection time for their own spirituality? Or their growth internally?
Yeah, I think actually that probably is true.
Yeah.
My congregation. I don't think it would have to be true.
No.
Of this position. Mm-hmm.
Another possibility would be that they are there are no real standards. Everybody is included. Therefore, there are no standards. There's nothing to shoot for.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's real good. The negative side of that would be to ask, hey, what about sin?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't Christ save us from and for? Doesn't it make a difference being a Christian? And if it really makes a difference, if it's a choice that changes your life, then how can you find, you know, such an easy continuity between you and the state, you and the world, the church and those outside of it? Isn't sin real? And probably the most famous for us proponents of this position were 19th century, particularly German-influenced Christians, but some of the social gospel in this country, not all of it, but some of it, where there was a real trust that if you could just educate people and show them that, you know, gosh, we're really creating structures that are harmful to people. You could just show them that, then people would say, whoa, I didn't know that. You know, I worked with a group that was a peace society and thought that the whole world could be converted to peace. And they said, the main thing is, you know, people support war because they don't realize how harmful it is. If they realized that, then they wouldn't support war anymore. And I think one of the things that they found out was that people support war not just because they're uneducated, but also because there's something twisted about us that finds expression in war. And you don't fix that just by showing people that they ought to do better, because sometimes we know what better is and we don't do it. Self-interest, things like that. Okay, well, that's this position over here. The opposite of it would be Christ against culture. And that would be, well, the early church in the apostolic age that we looked at, also the Anabaptists that we looked at yesterday. And what's that position like?
I remember they were the ones who had to separate themselves from the world,
mm-hmm.
and become people set apart, literally.
Yeah.
And their only obedience to civil law was just enough to keep them out of trouble. But they didn't subscribe to aims of the civil law.
They obeyed unless they were asked to do something that violated their religious conscience. But yeah, they weren't, it wasn't anything important to them. Civil laws were for who? Well, sinful people.
Outside, yeah. Mm-hmm.
People who needed to be coerced so that they wouldn't violently do harm to others. That's what the state is for, to prevent people from continuing in violent, sinful ways. You can't prevent it completely, of course, but you can coerce people enough so that they don't, you know, actually spend all their time murdering people, or that there are real laws that establish some kind of order and justice. But Christians in this position say, well, it's just, it really is the opposite of this in many ways. Sin is real. The world doesn't serve Christ, and we're called to serve Christ and to live like Christ did. So this is a group that loves the Sermon on the Mount, and they want to live it exactly, or as exactly as people can. So, no participation in government, because government is coercive. Of course, no participation in the military. What are some strengths you see with that position?
You don't get sucked in to equate one with the other in terms of culture and Christianity.
You definitely
have to know the differences between them. I mean, there's no gray area. It sounds like it's really cut and dry. It's one way or the other.
Yeah, that's right. There's a real certainty.
You're really intellectually involved in your doctrine, too. Of course, that's part of what they're saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just knowing the differences, it becomes important in the differences.
Yeah, I hear doctrine conceivably wouldn't matter that much. Over there, it is more important because the community wants to be a living example of rebirth. Lots of times I found that groups don't like this position very much. What don't you like about it?
Well, our mandate is to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God so loved the world, and if they withdraw from that, then they're not really dealing with the world God created and loved.
Mm-hmm. Let me suggest one author who's really good. He's a modern Mennonite. And if you ever have a chance to read anything by him, we've got some stuff in the bookstore. You might look at John Howard Yoder.
I just read one yesterday.
Oh, what'd you read?
Christ, Fullness of Christ.
Fullness of Christ, okay. I haven't read that one.
Yeah. I think it's a new one.
This is what he says.
that person that was running opposite me that night that I told you about was his teaching assistant, so that's how popular even those are associated with him are.
I gotta confess, I think I was not.
Knowing how Bill and Brian you are,
yeah, right.
She picked it up already.
Right.
Not that I wouldn't have liked to meet the fish. Okay, this is how he answers that question. Because this position gets hit with that criticism, and also, you know, just the argument, hey, you know, how can the world ever change? You know, if you prize this vision of the kingdom so much, why won't you work in order to make it a reality for everyone instead of just for your small group? And this is what they say, or this is what he says. Christ calls people to obedience, not to compromise. Right? That's the first thing you have to keep in your mind. So if we're called to obedience, and we know what that standard of life is, and grace renews us so that we truly can live in community with one another, then why would we ever be satisfied settling for anything less? Plus, he says, if you really want to establish the kingdom, or at least to create a situation as close to the kingdom as possible, why do you think that compromise is the way to do that? Christians have compromised for 2,000 years, and we're no closer to the kingdom now than we were in the beginning. What would really change the world, he says, is a truly political example that shows that there is a possibility of living in the kingdom. And that political example, he says, is the church as community, because that is an alternative political reality. And instead of debating it or trying to implement it among people who could care less, you get people together who really do care and say, you know, here, look at us. This is the work of Christ. It can be your life too. All right, so that's his answer. I don't know if you buy that or not.
Like so many things that are said, it sounds good. You know, it's a good theory. But what happens is that really most of the time those people become a threat.
They're always a threat. Always.
Rather than an example, they become
persecuted.
A threat.
But why are they a threat? What's threatening about them? And they always are. Always.
They're, by their very way of life and by their decision to live in that manner, they are, by their very manner of life, criticizing yours.
Or undermining it.
Or attempting.
The state sees them as undermining. What if everybody were like the Amish? Or to take a less severe example, like the Mennonites. You know, because many modern Mennonites live in modern ways. They don't all farm anymore. But if everyone were Mennonite, there certainly would be no army. You know, governments find that frightening. It is, in a sense, subversive. You know, they are obedient to government, but there are real limits as to what they can give to government. But Yoder would say, well, you know, what do you think conversion is? Don't you think it's a dying to one life and a rising to another? You know, it's got to be subversive. That's why Christianity is subversive. Any more thoughts on that one? Okay. By the way, I told you before, these types come from Richard Niebuhr, and you'll see by the one he puts in the middle, the one that he likes the most.
I couldn't find the book in the library. I couldn't
really?
Even find it in the card catalog.
Huh. But if that's true, I'll see that they ordered, but that
do you think
is
they
amazing.
Have it? I don't know.
I'm sure it has been there.
But it would be in the card catalog at least.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. If they
NIE? Huh. Did you look under NIEBER?
EUHR.
Yeah.
Did you look at Holden's list of blacklisted books? I don't think they've got one, but...
His first name is Helmut. It might not be under Richard, but Helmut.
H. Richard.
Yeah.
You probably...
Oh, still should be like my last name, though.
Richard Reinhold is how it was listed. There was another...
Oh, Richard Reinhold is his son.
Oh.
Yeah, look, H. Richard is what it would be listed.
It's a peculiar family.
Try again.
Okay, our next journey, according to Niebuhr, is Christ above culture. Any memories of who that might be?
Wasn't it Calvin?
That was Calvin's position?
No,
the Calvinist position is sympathetic to this one, actually. It's not Calvin, it's a great, great Catholic theologian.
Oh, going back that far, okay. I can't remember whether it was Augustine or Aquinas.
It's Aquinas. And here, an important buzzword to remember is natural law. Okay. This position assumes that if there'd never been a fall, there wouldn't be government, because you wouldn't need it. People would spontaneously obey God. Aquinas' position assumes just the opposite, that even if we were still living in the garden, there would have been multiplication of people, and we're inherently social. We relate to each other as well as, vertically to God, that we would have created structures to provide order and ensure justice. So Aquinas has a much more positive view of government than this position does. Here, government's a necessary evil. Here, government is a way of ordering our lives that makes us good citizens. And being a good citizen, respecting order and authority, is sort of the first step on the way to being a good Christian. He also says, everybody in the world has access to knowledge about God. That you can really see it the way people talk about experiencing God in nature when they come here. That even if you weren't a Christian, you would come here, be awestruck by the beauty, eventually reason your way back, and think that there was probably a creator responsible for it. Aquinas said that not only do people have that kind of knowledge, that there's a creator, they also know, or can know, that God wills certain kinds of living. Justice, for example. Justice and anger. And that, in fact, that's where we get our conscience from. How do people know good from bad? How do you know that, if I say, well, Louise was late for breakfast this morning, she should be shot.
Shot?
Oh, see, exactly. Yeah. Now, how do you know that that isn't proportionate?
Well, it just doesn't make sense. I mean,
how do you know?
Does not fit the crime.
How do you know?
I should go hungry. Not be shot.
How do you know? I mean, does anyone think she should be shot?
God,
Don't let personal feelings interfere.
Well, maybe that would just be the straw that broke the camel's back. There may have been thousands of other things, and this is the one that got
late every day.
You sound like a schoolgirl.
I don't think any of us would really advocate that. We would probably even speak up and protest.
A little bit.
Unless that would get you shot.
If we were terrorized, we might not.
Yeah, if we were terrorized, we would.
Maybe a squirt gun.
A squirt gun or something. Make her do dish team, that'll fix her.
Yeah.
But Aquinas would say, well, you could go anywhere in the world, whether people were Christian or not, and give that kind of example, and they would know that that was wrong. And I guess unless you went to some kind of culture where, being prompt as a god or something. But everybody would just know that justice, fairness, those kinds of things are real. And again, he said, well, that's natural law. God is expressed in the universe because the universe is a reflection. It is God's creation. And so it is orderly, and it does reveal God. Now, it doesn't reveal God completely, but it reveals these kinds of things about God. God is just. God is orderly. Morality is real. That's why we have a conscience. You know, we can talk intelligibly about matters of conscience. So Aquinas says, okay, everybody's got access to that.
And that's living in a dream world, then. Well, what about the Holocaust? There are millions of things going on all the time that do not follow that.
That's really good. Aquinas would say, it's not that the Germans didn't know it was wrong. It's that they did it anyway. And actually, if you read people's accounts, most, it seems to me that actually you may have a point there.
You can imagine that people that might be, but
people in the SS became conditioned to brutality and to inflicting it. But it's hard to imagine that in the beginning they thought it was right. Or I think they had to be conditioned to accept it. And I think in some ways maybe the constant repetition of brutality helped them to come to.
And you could say that about any kind of disastrous thing like that.
But what happened at the end of World War II?
Nuremberg.
Exactly. All right, Nuremberg trial is a perfect example to this appeal. Crimes against humanity only make sense if we can talk about humanity having some kind of common understanding.
The world court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those kinds of things.
But even in China, where the slightest robber is put on the front of a vehicle and run down the streets in broad daylight so that everybody sees that this guy has done something and is going to be killed. And they parade him down the street, strapped on the front of a vehicle, and then shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it's amazing people haven't stopped robbing in China.
Mm-hmm. There's not much.
Yeah, there's not much.
But now that kind of thing is like, you know, being late for dinner and getting shot for it almost.
Yeah.
There's no trial, there's no justice system.
But underlying that, nobody disagrees that it's wrong to rob, I suppose.
They don't know that he even really did it. They don't have a trial.
Okay, so the penalty's too severe. Certainly the system of determining guilt needs some work on, but people generally admit that robbing is wrong. Most of us would say robbing is wrong unless there are circumstances that can account for it. And we might say, well, if you went out on the boat and you were gonna fly out of Wenatchee, but you forgot to get your luggage off the boat, and you didn't have any money, and I don't know. You were there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you were really hungry, and then finally you robbed because you were starving. Most of us would say, well, that's extenuating.
Well, Jean Valjean, the bread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You may just not buy this, and that's great, too. Aquinas says, We do share a sense of valuing order, of thinking that things ought to be just and equitable, and that's what government does. That's its job, and anyone can do that. You don't need to be a Christian in order to establish a good government. And Aquinas also admitted that there were many people who weren't Christian who were very talented and could establish civilizations to be admired. Hi. It's just a little party for a moment. Now, but even knowing this, all this natural law stuff, there's still a lot more to know. You know that God is creator, but just by looking at the mountains, you'll never know that God is redeemer. And so Aquinas said, Christianity, the revelation that comes to us in scripture and in tradition, completes what we know through natural law. It adds to it, all right? And so Christ is above culture because Christ completes it. Here you have order and justice in culture. Here you have faith, hope, and love. Here you have a vision of a just society. Here the Christian has, well, sits really in the presence of God in eternity. That's what heaven is for Aquinas, just being in God's presence, the vision of God. But they don't really conflict. On some level, they do different things. Government is down here, church is up here, but they need not conflict. So you don't have to feel guilty like you do over here if you want to be both a Christian and involved in culture, particularly in government, say, because they don't conflict. In fact, they complement each other when they're done well. Anybody see anything good about that? I think you've shown very well the problem with it, with assuming that natural law is real or knowable, or, well, whether, I think Aquinas sort of assumed that people knew it in general, they might tend to follow it.
I don't know, the three models, I like it the best so far.
I see it as the modern complement of that as the family of man concept, you know, where everyone is really one underneath it all, and underneath all our cultural differences and so on, still we are one race. That's mm-hmm. where I see mm-hmm. that.
Okay. Yeah.
And we have the same basic morality and the same basic needs and so on. So we will, you know, that leads to the same kind of behavior, assuming that we're all having goodwill towards each other, sort of thing. That's the family of man mm-hmm. concept that mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, and I think natural law is both the best thing about this and also the most suspect. And you show it what's suspect about it. If everybody knows this natural law, how come the 20th century has been the century of
unnatural law?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why? Why, if we know better, do we do this to people in the millions? Okay. The fourth position. Culture and paradox. And our favorite example of that position is...
Oh, you mean the two kingdoms?
Yeah.
Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Explain it?
Oh, well, he, according to you, proposed that you...
I just made it up.
That it's, yeah.
I wanted to slam.
That he had supported government and that you sort of live with it and you do what you need to do and in spite of it. And that we can't expect it to be any different and be wonderful, and that there really isn't that possibility. Government is government, and it's something you just survive with and mm-hmm. go about your business. It's probably why there have been few Lutherans in the past in government. They don't tend, in the past, to mm-hmm. have gone into politics or mm-hmm. into any kind of administrative government.
Luther says they should, actually.
But they, why didn't they then? Why haven't they?
I think in Germany they do.
But America has sadly lacked Lutherans.
That's true. That's a good point. But, yeah, I don't really know how to...
But you're not automatically Lutheran if you're born in America either.
Well, I think the other thing is that historically, groups like Congregationalists and Episcopalians and Presbyterians and so forth, who came out, and those others came out of the Calvin tradition, have been the ones that have been more involved in government. What the reason for that is, other than the ones we've identified, whether there's other reasons or not, would be interesting to question.
Of course, they got here first, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of it.
A pretty eminent position, really.
Right. From the colonies, it was true.
Plus, didn't Lutherans in the beginning tend to go to the farmland?
Yeah, but Lutherans didn't come until quite later.
came.
Yeah, but when they did come, they went to the farms and to the lumbering areas. They didn't go to the law schools and to things like that, like the Episcopalian. And they didn't become business people as much, did they?
They're out on the frontier.
Yeah, they were. They stopped in Nebraska and Minnesota.
But look at this. These two positions really are quite close in their the way they analyze the situation. Where they're different is how they determine what you should, how you should react. Again, why is there government? Because there's sin. Government exists to stop the spread of sin, which would throw the world into chaos. Can you follow the Sermon on the Mount in government? No. As a citizen, you can't. Is the Sermon on the Mount the model that all Christians should follow? Yes. Again, those they agree with all those things. But Luther said, out of love for your neighbor, you really have to support the government. You don't have the luxury of this position. But you do have the obligation to follow the Sermon on the Mount. So in your private life, you do. And even down to being non-resistant if someone attacks you on the street. But in the world, and you know, Luther thought that most people, of course everybody was in the church because they were required to be baptized. And of course, I mean, they were taxed by the church too. Everybody was in. But he says, you know, most Christians, so-called Christians in the church are there because they have to be, not because in fact they are Christian. And you can't expect, you can't govern them according to the Sermon on the Mount. They'll just take advantage of it. If the police just say to people, go and sin no more, they'll go, but they'll sin some more. So have love for your neighbor, because you want your neighbor to be protected, to you know, just have the freedom and space to own property, to live a normal life. You have to support the government. And that's what you do in your calling as a citizen. In your calling as a Christian, you don't have no truck with that kind of life. You live according to the Sermon on the Mount. And you just have to ask yourself what situation you're in. Are you functioning as a citizen or as a Christian? And then you decide how to act. What's good about that?
Let you live in the world and still be a Christian.
Mm-hmm. And take Christianity very seriously.
Right.
What's bad about it?
It's what a heavenly, you're no earthly good.
Mm-hmm.
Let you live in the world and still be a Christian. That's same thing that's good about it is what's bad about it. I think most people would say, studying Luther himself, that he had a strong stress on order, and in his time, very little stress on justice. And I don't think that that's necessary to this position, but that's the way that Luther laid it out. If he had to choose between the two, he went with order. And he didn't feel that all demands for just laws, you know, decent pay, better living conditions, those were not of the gospel. They may be human rights, he said, but they're not gospel rights. And so it's really hard to justify revolution, no matter how bad things are for Luther. And as a result, this position, perhaps not necessarily, but at least historically, has been, well, not as worried about justice as it is about order. It's been sort of authoritarian, actually. Okay, finally, in the middle, the best, according to Luther, I mean to Niebuhr, Christ transforming culture. And again, I mean, this is just his prejudice. This was his tradition, actually. And what's that one like? Besides the crowning point of the Christian faith.
The what?
The crowning point of the Christian faith. See, life really began with Calvin. people could just learn these things. Ask any Presbyterian, they'll tell you.
Well, isn't that exactly what it says, transforming, mm-hmm. that you get in the system and you work it and you make it right.
Mm-hmm. Unlike Aquinas, it would say that a really good government won't just be obeying natural law. There's something distinctive about Christianity. And so the best government will reflect Christian standards, Christian morality. Again, the assumption is that we're created to be in community with each other. So you needn't feel bad about participating in culture and in government. We're created for that. The problem is that as things now stand, culture is pretty bad, government's pretty bad. What you need to do is transform it. The examples, well, the famous examples in history that we have of this, of Geneva, for example, or Massachusetts Bay, the thing that everybody feels uneasy about is, you know, what kind of stories or images do we have of pyramids?
They're rigid.
Rigid, yeah, rigid is a good word. Actually, Puritans had a lot more fun than we now think they did. But the way this was practiced in Geneva, and really in Massachusetts Bay too, it was an ethic of commitment. You chose to live there. You chose to be a part of a holy experiment. You wanted, a buzzword is, a visibly holy society. No one can really make you holy inside except for God. But at least the state can seek to be visibly holy. Well, for people who really weren't into being visibly holy in quite that manner, it feels very intolerant. Actually is very intolerant.
But you can go there someplace else. If your name's Roger William and it's the middle of the winter and you have nothing on your back, we won't put you to death, just send you out in the wilderness.
If Roger Williams had just kept his mouth shut, they would have let him leave in the spring. But he kept talking after they told him to be quiet.
Would that be looked upon as a fairly elitist kind of existence then for this holy society from the outside?
Yeah, outsiders would see it that way. Again, I think it might... I don't think that you have to have it be so rigid and intolerant. I think it's possible to be committed to transforming the culture at the same time that you recognize that, well, it's never going to be a monochromatic culture. It's going to be, like our own culture today. It's never going to be 100% Christian. So what we need to do is, look at Christian sentiments and what it is that we seek to do for people in the world and try to translate that into laws that are livable for people.
Is that then saying that Christianity is the only, is the religion for the world?
Yeah, I think, or it's saying, well, you can make that claim with any of these as far as that goes. What it's saying is, it's a little different from this position, because Aquinas is saying, you don't really need any special kind of Christian revelation to know what government is. This position is saying, you really do. Really, to have a vision of the kingdom, you need that. And having that vision, what you ought to do is try to transform the structures around you so that they reflect that vision. You need revelation for that.
What would Calvin in this position do with render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's?
Well, Calvin wouldn't have any trouble with
what
that.
What would he say?
Even in Geneva, the church and the government were completely separate. They did different things. Like if the church Well, like the church would never arrest somebody in Geneva, and the state would never rule on what the Bible says.
The church would just make sure the state arrested people in a Christianly way.
Yeah, there's a real close cooperation. Well, it's government's job to maintain order,
mm-hmm.
and it's the church's job to interpret the Bible. And in a Christian society, super Christian society, well, not just vaguely religious, but a Christian society, you'd want your laws to be consistent with what the Bible says. So the church tells you what the Bible says, the government writes laws consistent with that, the church preaches, government enforces. If people screw up too bad.
The main problem that I see with that point of view is that the visibly holy society, once again, in theory, is something that probably all Christians sort of dream about, you know, would sort of like. But who is going to set these laws? You know, which Christians are going to set the standards? And will you be able to agree with them? In other words, will you be able to shut up when you disagree? Mm-hmm. Will you be able to support laws, Christian supposedly laws, that you don't agree with?
Yeah.
And that's the problem that Roger Williams had. That's the problem of, well, why does every denomination get formed?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had a problem with somebody else's vision.
Yeah, and in our own society, we can certainly see that.
Yes.
You know, with the push for conservative Christians to become more active in government, we often find, you know, Christians profoundly disagreeing on what it is to have a just society. Not even a Christian society, just a just society consistent with Christianity.
And how they interpret, like, even the abortion issues mm-hmm. or anything like that. Interpretation of, I mean, how ghastly if that got pushed.
Is it things pro-choice like, or anti-baby? You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And as we know, what you label something has a lot to do with the reality that people perceive.
Just the fact of John Calvin being one individual who was charismatic and powerful in his community.
Not charismatic.
Well, charismatic
he was,
in the sense
real
of being
cold fish. Yeah,
but
he had a lot of
influence. Okay, I'm talking about the charismatic in the dictionary sense. Was a perfect illustration of this. You know, anybody who didn't agree with Calvin could leave.
Yeah,
be free
that's
to
true.
Leave.
That's
right?
True.
Okay. So, yeah. In other words, I could not be a Christian in his society unless I agreed with all his rules.
You couldn't be a Genevan. You could be a Christian
in his society.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Although, again, I don't necessarily think that this position couldn't function in a pluralistic society. I think another strand of the social gospel attempted to transform culture, to care for those who had fallen into the cracks of the factory system, and to say, listen, your workers are your neighbors too. You don't treat people like this. If you're going to take, if you're going to raise the money and take the risk of having a factory, and you're going to involve people's lives like this, you're responsible to those people. If you're, you know, you can't, employers can't ignore the social creation that their very type of employment is responsible for. And people have been saying that. You know, that's the workers' problem. Business must run according to the laws of capital. And that's just the way it is. And so the social gospel was saying, well, no. You know, we don't want to live according to that ethic. We want to live according to an ethic that's more like the gospel.
Well, are you saying that these five examples are what was, you know, Aquinas lived a long time ago, so did Luther, so did Calvin.
Niebuhr
saying this is modern day thought?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I don't see that as what Luther said as what Lutherans today do. Lots of them march, lots of them climb mm-hmm. walls, lots of them protest, mm-hmm. lots of them do lots of things, and they are not sanctioned for it.
I mean, yeah, well, that means either they're modifying this position, or, in fact, they're not in this position anymore. They're in something else.
I would say that the majority of socially active Lutherans have basically rejected the concept of two kingdoms.
Mm-hmm. They might be much more over here, yeah. mm-hmm. actually.
The other problem with yeah. with the middle one is, of course, assuming that somehow or other humanity can bring in the kingdom, that the kingdom of God is something that's going to come through our effort.
Yeah, of course, Calvin didn't assume that, and he didn't assume that everyone in Geneva would even go to heaven. And that's God's choice. What he said was, it can be visibly holy, it can be obedient to the laws of Scripture. Calvin didn't think that would be the kingdom. But certainly people have thought that, and especially in this position. Again, because there's not such a stress on sin, sort of an assumption that, you know, people will just get it together. Already we can live as though we were in the kingdom. It's a matter of will, not a matter of, you know, a basic human inability to do that. You just got to put your mind to it, kind of thing. Well, if you had to pick a position, well, let's play a little chariot. We got a little bit of time left.
We could each try.
You could each take one of those, yeah.
And try to defend.
Well, what do you like? Let's just pick what we'd have to be if we had to be something. What would you think?
We have to live in one of those. Which one
yeah. Or unless you can think of another one. In which case, we'll throw out Richard Niebuhr and we'll put your book in the library. I like them all.
They each have, as you said before, you know, you've been doing all this time. They each have their strengths and their weaknesses.
Yeah, for myself, this is the one position that I can't live with. I think I've been in all four of those.
Yeah, I was going to say I've been in different positions at different times.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out what.
Of course, we've got all of them functioning in our society.
Oh,
cross fertilizations
sure.
and
yeah.
mixtures mm-hmm. of them. And
also, I think it would be a mistake to say, well, I have to pick one of these and be it forever. I think partly it depends when you live and where. I think where Christians are persecuted, this is the only position. It's a position for persecuted Christians. It may also be a position for all Christians anyway, but especially when Christians are persecuted, I think you get pushed into this one.
The trouble is, getting in that without being persecuted brings on persecution.
Mm-hmm. But you know, it's so easy to be a cultural Christian, and mm-hmm. for Christianity really not to mean much of anything.
To get deluded?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sermon on the Mount really is radical.
I think the most exciting one would be the transforming.
Transforming.
To make the change in
yeah.
society,
mm-hmm.
which might push you into a separate culture if they thought you were undermining by transforming society.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why this position rejects that. You know, again, it's that whole thing of compromise. I mean, like, okay, they're in Geneva, you know, all kinds of stuff about when should you kill people in the Old Testament. So they got these civil laws that allow for capital punishment. And Calvin's very comfortable with that. Yes. It's there in the Bible. Yeah, except it's in those people up the wall. It might be in the Bible, but it's not in the Sermon on the Mount. And that's the way they want to live. So they say, yeah, you're transforming, all right. You're making it better. But, you know, it's like some Christian, no matter how good you make it. You might really even create a society where everyone had food and laws were basically just, but it still wouldn't be over here into that.
Well, I think I'd rather work towards getting a just neutral, maintaining your Christianity rather than going off in your own little niche someplace, totally disregarding everything, and just say, I'm a Christian, and you know, forget you. And I'd rather at least show my Christianity by helping doing some of these things. I may not demand that they believe my beliefs.
And now you're moving into culture and paradox.
Yeah. Yeah, Mennonites are, as you know, very active on the mission field and very, very active in helping victims of disasters, non-political kinds of things. They are very giving people, but only in certain ways. I mean, they're not political ways.
I would say, living...
Is this going to create a Russian?
I would say living at Holden is probably against culture.
It definitely often has that feel, I think.
And that's neat for a while.
Yeah,
when we did it for a while, it was living here was great. Mm-hmm. But you have to go back. You can't stay in that kind of thing and really have a real reality.
Yeah, I guess people who come here regularly find maybe sort of a rhythm about it. You get real Christian and then you go back and you try to explain to people what happened to you, and then the next time you come back and get real Christian.
No, I think that's true.
Okay.
You don't get real Christian. Maybe some do.
Okay,
it's just out of getting in touch with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Time to sort of stop the world.
Well, let's just do hands.
How many times can we raise?
A question here.
All right. Yeah.
I think it's a simple question. That's transforming really culture now. You're not out to make everybody a Christian.
No. Well, it depends. Okay. Let's say that's no. That's not only God. But you might. It's conceivable you might want to create a Bible commonwealth. Or, if you're willing to live with pluralism, then you mainly just want to create a just commonwealth. So, you know, if order's big here, order and justice is big here. Although, again, there's nothing in this position that precludes justice being important. Okay, how many people... If they could only raise their hand one single time, would raise their hand here. Zero.
I don't know. I'm sitting on the line.
Usually I make people just stand, but I'm letting you raise it. What about this one?
I've been in that one, and I'm moving out of that, and I don't know where I'm moving to.
Okay. What about this one?
I'd say I'm halfway between three and four.
Okay.
Probably a Christ in culture, if there is such a...
Okay.
I would accept transforming culture with a label on myself as I am a minority or I am
tolerant.
In other words, it has to be pluralistic for me to accept it.
Yeah. Why not just go here? Then you'll even have the problem.
Because then there's no redemptive work.
But that's no problem because government doesn't redeem. Church does. In this position. See?
But I don't like that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to vote for that position.
It sounds good.
Well, I thought it was between these two over here, but I can't stand it between these two over here, so I've run over there to try that one.
Yeah, I mean, Calvin does.
I've even been visiting Catholic Church, so maybe I am over there.
Calvin wants the state as part of the order of redemption. Aquinas doesn't. So maybe... Yeah.
Maybe that's the closest one I'm at.
You can still
one.
Work for justice and still be compassionate about it, but what you won't be assuming is that government is somehow particularly Christian. All right, how about this one? Well, you know, you couldn't vote for this one after I voted against it.
Well, that's not true.
So what's the numbers?
I didn't count. It looks to me like we've got one person here and everybody, one, two. Well, wait.
I'm halfway, too. Yeah,
wait.
There.
Okay.
Yeah.
Two weenies. three people here.
With the proviso.
Yeah, the Christ in culture is a nice way of putting it.
Okay. And how do you see that one working? Now that everyone is rushing toward it, what makes Christ in culture different from either one of those?
Well, the transforming implies in that you introduce a whole lot of gray area where you compromise. Mm-hmm. Where Christ in culture, you can still work for the common good, but you still maintain your perhaps differing beliefs.
In but not of.
And you can also perhaps hope that by your life you might, and your love, you might draw somebody to Christ. Mm-hmm. 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 That's what I like about it.
Well, I guess for me it also affirms the notion that God is going to bring in the kingdom, not us. That's what I don't like about the transforming terminology, at any rate. Somehow, if we work hard enough, you know, that the kingdom's going to arrive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The kingdom's going to arrive, you know, whether we do anything about it or not. Mm-hmm. That's part of the gospel. But I also am comfortable with the notion of Christ being in and amongst what is going on in the world and society and culture and government. He's not above it. He's not against it. He's not off in left field as he is in the two kingdom one. And that's why I would create a 3.5 one there.
Okay.
You know. Could you go with it? Because he is in it, he is transforming it?
Yeah, as long as it's God that's doing it, and we are there as his instruments, to use the illustration from the Bible study this morning, the branches of the vine. And as Jeff pointed out, it's not the vine that bears the fruit, it's the branches that bear the fruit. But they've got to be in touch with that in order for that to happen.
I don't know.
It may not be totally visible either, you see. Mm-hmm. There's a hiddenness about it. Deus absconditus.
Yeah.
I don't like the exclusiveness that it seems to be in that number 3.
That's the problem. See, it's tough, that particularity.
It's just too exclusive.
Is scandalous.
So.
Yeah, it is. You've all heard that term, the scandal, particularity. That's what it means. It's really hard to be totally committed and tolerant to. Open-minded.
Somehow that position between the 3 and 4 there seems to be most typical contemporary Lutheran. Mm-hmm. The front of the bus and the back of the church in the middle of the road.
Say it again.
Front of the bus, the back of the church, in the middle of the road. That's where most Christians find themselves. Problem is, that's where most accidents occur.
Ooh. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,